This is Audible.
Hello and welcome to this special unabridged recording of The Eighth Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness, written and voiced by Dr. Stephen R. Covey. I'm Boyd Craig, director of Stephen R. Covey Publishing, and it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Covey in this new audio program. In The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Dr. Covey showed us how to become effective. Here in The Eighth Habit, his long-awaited audiobook, he opens up an entirely new dimension of human potential and shows us that we as individuals and organizations have within us the capacity to achieve greatness. Being effective as individuals and organizations is no longer merely an option. Survival in today's world requires it. But in order to thrive, innovate, excel, and lead in what Stephen calls the new knowledge worker age, we must build on and move beyond effectiveness. The call of this new era in human history is for greatness. It is for fulfillment, passionate execution, and significant contribution. Accessing the higher levels of human genius and motivation in today's new reality requires a sea change in thinking, a new mindset, a new skill set, a new tool set, in short, a whole new habit. Before I turn this over to Stephen, you will notice that we have included a special DVD containing 16 inspirational companion films. To obtain the most effective learning out of this program, may I encourage you to follow Stephen's instructions, pause this audio program, and watch the short films as they are introduced throughout the audio program. Now here is Dr. Covey.
The Eighth Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness. The first three chapters deal with the pain, the problem, and the solution. Chapter 1, The Pain. Listen to the voices. I'm stuck. I'm in a rut. Another. I have no life. I'm burned out, exhausted. Another. No one really values or appreciates me. My boss doesn't have a clue of all I'm capable of. Another. I don't feel especially needed. Not at work, not by my teenage and grown children, not by my neighbors and community, not even by my spouse, except to pay the bills. Another. I'm frustrated and discouraged. Another. I'm just not making enough to make ends meet. I never seem to get ahead. Another. Maybe I just don't have what it takes. Another. I'm not making a difference. Another. I feel empty inside. My life lacks meaning. Something's missing. Another. I'm angry. I'm scared. I can't afford to lose my job. Another. I'm lonely. Another. I'm stressed out. Everything's urgent. Another. I'm micromanaged and suffocating. Another. I'm sick of all of the backstabbing politics and the kissing up. Another. I'm bored. Just putting in my time. Most of my satisfactions come off the job. Another. I'm beat up to get the numbers. The pressure to produce is unbelievable. I simply don't have the time or resources to do it all. Another. With a spouse who doesn't understand and kids who don't listen or obey, home is no better than work. Another. If only people understood, they'd come to realize I cannot change things. These are typical of the voices of people at work and at home. Voices of literally millions of parents, laborers, service providers, managers, professionals, and executives all over the world who are fighting to make it in the new reality. The pain is personal, and it's deep. You may relate with many of the statements yourself. As Carl Rogers once said, "What is most personal is most general." Of course, some people are engaged, contributing, and energized in their work, but far too few. I frequently ask large audiences, how many agree that the vast majority of the workforce in your organization possesses far more talent, intelligence, capability, and creativity than their present jobs require or even allow? The overwhelming majority of the people raise their hands, and this is with groups all over the world. About the same percentage acknowledge that they are under immense pressure to produce more for less. Just think about it. People face a new and increasing expectation to produce more for less in a terribly complex world, yet they are simply not allowed to use a significant portion of their talents and intelligence. In no way is this pain more clearly or practically manifest in organizations than in their inability to focus on and execute their highest priorities, using what we call the XQ, which stands for execution quotient, a questionnaire, a tool. Harris Interactive, the originators of the Harris Poll, recently polled 23,000 U.S. residents employed full-time within key industries and in key functional areas. Just consider a few of their most stunning findings. These are truly shocking. Only 37% said that they have a clear understanding of what their organization is trying to achieve and why. Only 1 in 5 was enthusiastic about their team's and organization's goals. Only 1 in 5 workers said that they have a clear line of sight between their tasks and their team's and organization's goals. Only half were satisfied with the work they have accomplished at the end of the week. Only 15% felt that their organization fully enables them to execute key goals. Only 15% felt that they worked in a high-trust environment. Only 17% felt that their organization fosters open communication that is respectful of differing opinions and that results in new and better ideas. Only 10% felt that their organization holds people accountable for results. Only 20% fully trusted the organization they work for. Only 13% have high trust, highly cooperative working relationships with other groups or departments. If, say, a soccer team had these same scores, only 4 of the 11 players on the field would know which goal is theirs. Only 2 of the 11 would even care. Only 2 of the 11 would know what position they play and know exactly what they are supposed to do. Now listen to this one. And all but 2 players would in some way be competing against their own team members rather than the opponent. The data is sobering. It matches my own experience with people in organizations of all kinds, all around the world. Despite all our gains in technology, product innovation, and world markets, most people are not thriving in the organizations they work for. They are neither fulfilled nor excited. They are frustrated. They are not clear about where the organization is headed or what its highest priorities are. They are simply not on the same page. They are bogged down and distracted. Most of all, they don't feel that they can change much. Can you imagine the personal and organizational cost of failing to fully engage the passion, talent, and intelligence of the workforce? It is far greater than all taxes, interest charges, and labor costs put together. New heading. Why an eighth habit? The world has profoundly changed since The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People was published in 1989. The challenges and complexity we face in our personal lives and relationships, in our families, in our professional lives, and in our organizations are of a different order of magnitude. In fact, many mark 1989, the year we witnessed the fall of the Berlin Wall, as the beginning of the information age, the birth of a new reality, a sea change of incredible significance, truly a new era. Many have asked whether the seven habits are still relevant in today's new reality. My answer is always the same. The greater the change and the more difficult the challenges, the more relevant they become. You see, the seven habits are about becoming highly effective. They represent a complete framework of universal, timeless principles of character and human effectiveness. In short, principles never change. They are universal. They apply everywhere. They are timeless. And they are essentially self-evident, such as, you can never sustain trust without trustworthiness. That is a self-evident principle. But being effective as individuals and organizations is no longer optional in today's highly competitive world. It is simply the price of entry to the playing field. But surviving, thriving, innovating, excelling, and leading in this new reality will require us to build on and reach beyond effectiveness. The call and need of a new era is for greatness. It's for fulfillment, passionate execution, and significant contribution. These are on a different plane or dimension. They are different in kind, just as significance is different in kind, not in degree, from success. Tapping into the higher reaches of human genius and motivation, what we could call voice, requires a new mindset, a new skill set, a new tool set, a new habit. The eighth habit, then, is not about adding one more habit to the seven, one that somehow got forgotten. It's about seeing and harnessing the power of a third dimension to the seven habits that meets the central challenge of the new knowledge worker age. This eighth habit is find your voice and inspire others to find theirs. The eighth habit represents the pathway to the enormously promising side of today's reality. It stands in stark contrast to the pain and frustration of the voices I've been describing. In fact, it is a timeless reality. It is the voice of the human spirit, full of hope and intelligence, resilient by nature, boundless in its potential to serve the common good. This voice also encompasses the soul of organizations that will survive and thrive and profoundly impact the future of the world. In your mind's eye, try to envision, to imagine four overlapping circles. The nexus, or the intersection area, representing voice, one's unique personal significance. These are the four circles that overlap. Talent, what you're good at. Passion, what you love doing. Conscience, what you feel is right, what you should be doing. And need. Need is the area where there is pain, where there is hurt, where there is a place to add value, in all parts of society. Talent, passion, conscience, and need, overlapping. The intersection area is voice, one's unique personal significance. Voice is exactly that, unique personal significance. Significance that is revealed as we face our greatest challenges and which makes us equal to them. As I've mentioned, voice lies at the nexus of talent, your natural gifts and strengths, passion, those things that naturally energize, excite, motivate, and inspire you, need, including what the world needs enough to pay you for, that can drive your economic engine, and conscience, that still, small voice within, that assures you of what is right and what prompts you to actually do it. When you engage in work that taps your talents and fuels your passion, that rises out of a great need in the world that you feel drawn by conscience to meet, therein lies your voice, your calling, your soul's code. There is a deep, innate, almost inexpressible yearning within each one of us to find our own voice in life. The exponential revolutionary explosion of the Internet is one of the most powerful modern manifestations of this truth. The Internet is perhaps the perfect symbol of the new world, of the information knowledge worker economy, and of the dramatic changes that have occurred. In their 1999 book, Clue Train Manifesto, authors Locke, Levine, Searles, and Weinberger put it this way, quote, "All of us are finding our voices again, learning how to talk to one another. Inside, outside, there's a conversation going on today that hasn't happened at all 5 years ago and hasn't been very much in evidence since the Industrial Revolution began. Now, spanning the planet via the Internet and World Wide Web, this conversation is so vast, so multifaceted, that trying to figure out what it's about is futile. It's about a billion years of pent-up hopes and fears and dreams, coated in serpentine double helixes, the collective flashback déjà vu of our strange, perplexing species. Something ancient, elemental, sacred, something very, very funny that's broken loose in the pipes and wires of the 21st century. There are millions and millions of threads in this conversation, but at the beginning and end of each one is a human being. This fervid desire for the web bespeaks a longing so intense that it can only be understood as spiritual. A longing indicates something is missing in our lives. What is missing is the sound of the human voice. The spiritual lure of the web is the promise of the return of voice." Close quote. Rather than further describe voice, let me illustrate it through the true story of one man. When I met Muhammad Yunus, founder of the Grameen Bank, a unique organization established for the sole purpose of extending microcredit to the poorest of the poor, I asked him when and how he had gained his vision. He said he didn't have any vision to begin with at all. He simply saw someone in need and tried to fill it, and the vision evolved. Muhammad Yunus's vision of a poverty-free world was set in motion with a little simple event on the streets of Bangladesh. While interviewing him for my syndicated column on leadership, he shared his story with me. Listen to his words. "It all started 25 years ago. I was teaching economics at a university in Bangladesh. The country was in the middle of a famine. I felt terrible. Here I was, teaching the elegant theories of economics in the classroom with all the enthusiasm of a brand new PhD from the United States. But I would walk out of the classroom and see skeletons all around me, people waiting to die. I felt that whatever I had learned, whatever I was teaching, was all make-believe stories with no meaning for people's lives. So I started trying to find out how people lived in the village next door to the university campus. I wanted to find out whether there was anything I could do as a human being to delay or to stop the death, even for one single person. I abandoned the bird's-eye view that lets you see everything from above, from the sky. I assumed a worm's-eye view, trying to find whatever comes right in front of you. Smell it. Touch it. See if you can do something about it. One particular incident took me in a new direction. I met a woman who was making bamboo stools. After a long discussion, I found out that she made only 2 US pennies each day. I couldn't believe anybody could work so hard and make such beautiful bamboo stools, yet make such a tiny amount of profit. She explained to me that because she didn't have the money to buy the bamboo to make the stools, she had to borrow from the trader. And the trader imposed the condition that she had to sell the product to him alone, at a price that he decided. And that explains the 2 pennies. She was virtually in bonded labor to this person. And how much did the bamboo cost? She said, oh, about 20 cents. For a very good one, 25 cents. I thought, people suffer for 20 cents, and there is nothing anyone can do about it? I debated whether I should give her 20 cents. But then I came up with another idea. Let me make a list of people who needed that kind of money. I took a student of mine, and we went around the village for several days and came up with a list of 42 such people. When I added up the total amount they needed, I got the biggest shock of my life. It added up to $27. I felt ashamed of myself for being part of a society which could not provide even $27 to 42 hard-working, skilled human beings. To escape that shame, I took the money out of my pocket and gave it to my student and said, you take this money and give it to those 42 people that we met and tell them this is a loan, but they can pay me back whenever they are able to. In the meantime, they can sell their products wherever they can get a good price. After receiving the money, they were very excited, and seeing that excitement made me think, what do I do now? I thought of the branch bank, which was located on the campus of the university, and I went to the manager and suggested that he lend money to the poor people that I had met in the village. He fell from the sky. He said, you are crazy. It's impossible. How could we lend money to poor people? They are not creditworthy. I pleaded with him and said, at least give it a try. Find out. It's only a small amount of money. He said, no, our rules don't permit it. They cannot offer collateral, and such a tiny amount is not worth lending. He suggested that I see the high officials in the banking hierarchy in Bangladesh. I took his advice, and I went to the people who matter in the banking section. Everyone told me the same thing. Finally, after several days of running around, I offered myself as a guarantor. I'll guarantee the loan. I'll sign whatever they want me to sign, and they can give me the money, and I'll give it to the people that I want to. So that was the beginning. They warned me repeatedly that the poor people who receive the money will never pay it back. I said, I'll take a chance. And the surprising thing was, they repaid me every penny. I got very excited and came to the manager and said, look, they pay back. There's no problem. But he said, oh no, they're just fooling you. Soon they will take more money and never pay you back. So I gave them more money and they paid me back. I told this to the manager again, but he said, well, maybe you can do it in one village, But if you do it in two villages, it won't work. And I hurriedly did it in two villages, and it worked. So it became a kind of struggle between me and the bank manager and his colleagues in the highest positions. They kept saying that a larger number, five villages probably, will show it. So I did it in five villages, and it only showed that everybody paid back. Still, they didn't give up. They said 10 villages, 50 villages, 100 villages. And so it became a kind of contest between them and me. I came up with results that they could not deny because it was their money that I was giving. But they would not accept it because they are trained to believe that poor people are not reliable. Luckily, I was not trained that way, so I could believe whatever I was seeing as it revealed itself. But the bankers' minds, their eyes were blinded by the knowledge they had. Finally, I had the thought, why am I trying to convince them? I am totally convinced that poor people can take money and pay it back. Why don't we set up a separate bank? That excited me, and I wrote down the proposal and went to the government to get the permission to set up a bank. It took me 2 years to convince the government. On October 2nd, 1983, we became a bank, a formal, independent bank. And what excitement for all of us, now that we had our own bank and we could expand as we wished. And expand we did. Each year, they lend about $500 million. They lend even to beggars to help them come out of begging and start selling. Grameen Bank now works in more than 46,000 villages in Bangladesh through 1,267 branches with over 12,000 staff members. They have lent more than $4.5 billion in loans of $12 to $15, averaging under $200. A housing loan is $300. These are small numbers to those of us in business, but think in terms of the individual impact. To lend $500 million annually required 3.7 million people, 96% of whom are women, to make a decision that they could and would take steps to change their lives and the lives of their families. 3.7 million people had to decide that they were capable of creating change. 3.7 million people survived the sleepless night to show up trembling but committed at the Grameen office the next morning. At the heart of this empowerment lies individual women who chose individually and in synergistic, norm-producing groups to become self-reliant, independent entrepreneurs producing goods out of their own homes or neighborhoods or backyards to become economically viable and successful. They found their voice, the overlapping of passion, talent, to meet need as driven by conscience. As I have studied and interviewed some of the world's great leaders, I notice that their sense of vision and voice has usually evolved slowly. I am sure there are exceptions. Some may have a vision of what is possible suddenly burst upon their consciousness. But generally speaking, I find that vision comes as people sense human need and respond to their conscience in trying to meet that need. And when they meet that need, they see another and meet that, and on. Little by little, they begin to generalize a sense of need and start thinking of ways to institutionalize their efforts so that they can be sustained. This taps deeply into their talents and into their passion. Muhammad Yunus is an example of a man who did exactly that, sensed human need and responded to conscience by applying his talent and passion to meet that need, first personally, then in building trust and searching for creative solutions to problems. and finally by institutionalizing the capacity to fill the needs of society through an organization. He found his voice in inspiring others to find theirs. Again, he found his voice in inspiring others to find theirs. The microcredit, sometimes called microfinancing movement, is now spreading across the entire world. Mother Teresa once said, "Few of us can do great things, but all of us can do small things with great love." New heading: The Pain, the Problem, the Solution. I've begun by describing the pain of the workforce. It is felt by people at every level of every kind of organization. It is felt in families, in communities, and in society generally. The purpose of this book is to give you a roadmap that will lead you from such pain and frustration to true fulfillment, relevance, significance, and contribution in today's new landscape, not only in your work and organization, but also in your whole life. In short, it will lead you to find your voice. Then, if you so choose, it will also lead you to greatly expand your influence, regardless of your position. Inspiring others you care about, your team and your organization, to find their voices, and to increase many-fold their effectiveness, growth, and impact. You will discover that such influence and leadership comes by choice, not from position or rank. The best and often only way to break through pain to a lasting solution is to first understand the fundamental problem causing the pain. In this case, much of the problem lies in behavior that flows out of an incomplete or deeply flawed paradigm or view of human nature, one that undermines people's sense of worth and straitjackets their talents and potential. The solution to the problem is like most significant breakthroughs in human history. It comes from a fundamental break with old ways of thinking, old paradigms, old models. The purpose of this book is that if you will be patient and pay the price of understanding the root problem, and then set a course of living the timeless, universal principles embodied in the solution outlined in the book, your influence will steadily grow from the inside out. You will find your voice and will inspire your team and organization to find theirs in a dramatically changed world. Chapter 1 has briefly touched on this painful reality. Chapter 2 identifies the core problem. Understanding this deeply entrenched problem, we shed a profound light on the challenges we face personally, in our family and work relationships, and in the organizations in which we spend much of our lives. Chapter 2 will require some mental effort, 12 pages worth, but the investment of delving into the human side of what has happened in organizations over the last century will give you the key paradigm, the key model, the key way of thinking for the rest of the book, and will begin to give you wisdom, guidance, and power in dealing with many of the most significant personal and relationship challenges and the opportunities you face. So hang in there. It will be worth it. It's only 12 pages long. Then Chapter 3 provides an overview of the Eighth Habit solution that unfolds in the remainder of the book, and a brief section on how to get the most out of this book. Before moving on to the next chapter, I would like to invite you to first view a little 3-minute film called Legacy. It has been shown in movie theaters across the United States and in many presentations throughout the entire world. It is a very inspiring film. It will give you a few moments to reflect on the core elements of your voice and the four corresponding universal human needs: living, loving, learning, and leaving a legacy. It will subtly communicate the book's one basic model or paradigm discussed in the next chapter, what I call the whole person model. In the chapters of this book, I will refer to a short film like this one, which attempts to teach the essence of the content of that chapter. You have essentially two brains. Your left brain will deal more with words and analysis and logic, content. Your right brain deals more with emotion, with intuition, with visualization. In this way, you bring both sides of your brain together. The content for the left, the visualization and emotion for the right. You will find that these films, many of which have won prestigious national and international film awards, on the DVD that is included with the book. The films, some true to life and others fictionalized, are powerful and charged with emotion. I'm convinced that they will enable you to better see, feel, and understand this material. I also believe you'll enjoy them. You'll find tremendous value in them. If you're not interested in the films, that's fine. Just skip the references to them and move on. But I encourage you strongly to take both approaches, the words and the films. They will reinforce each other, and the synergy will produce amazing feelings and insights that I think you might miss if you only listen. Now simply insert the DVD into your DVD player and select Legacy from the menu. Enjoy. Chapter 2, The Problem. We are witnesses to one of the most significant shifts in human history. Peter Drucker, one of the greatest management thinkers of our time, puts it this way. In a few hundred years, when the history of our time is written from a long-term perspective, it is likely that the most important event those historians will see is not technology, not the internet, not e-commerce. It is an unprecedented change in the human condition. For the first time, literally, substantial and rapidly growing numbers of people have choices. For the first time, they will have to manage themselves. And society is totally unprepared for it. Close quote. To understand the core problem and the profound implications of Drucker's prophetic statement, we must look first at the context of history, namely, the five ages of civilization's voice. First, the hunter and gatherer age. Second, the agricultural age. Third, the industrial age. Fourth, the information knowledge worker age. And finally, an emerging age of wisdom. Imagine for a moment that you take a step back in time and are a hunter and a gatherer of food. Each day you go out with a bow and arrow or stones and sticks to gather food for your family. That's all you've ever known, seen, and done to survive. Now imagine someone comes up to you and tries to persuade you to become what he calls a farmer. What do you think your response would be? You see him go out and scratch the earth and throw little seeds into the ground, and you see nothing. You see him watering the soil and removing weeds, and you still see nothing. But eventually, you see a great harvest. You notice his yield as a farmer is 50 times greater than yours as a hunter and gatherer. And you are considered one of the best. What would you do? You would likely say to yourself, even if I wanted to, I couldn't do that. I don't have the skills. I don't have the tools. You just wouldn't know how to work that way. But the farmer is so productive that you see him making enough money to send his kids to school and give them great opportunities, and you are barely surviving. Little by little, you're drawn to go through the intense learning process of becoming a farmer. You raise your children and grandchildren as farmers. That's exactly what happened in our early history. There was a downsizing of hunters and gatherers of over 90%. They lost their jobs. By choice. Several generations pass, and along comes the Industrial Age. People build factories and learn specialization, delegation, and scalability, and replicability. They learn how to take raw materials through an assembly line with very high levels of efficiency. The productivity of the Industrial Age goes up 50 times over the family farm. Now, if you were a farmer producing 50 times more than hunters and gatherers, and all of a sudden you see an industrial factory rise up and start outproducing the family farm by 50 times, what would you say? You might be jealous, even threatened. But what would you need to be a player in the Industrial Age? You would need a completely new skill set and tool set. More importantly, you'd need a new mindset, a new way of thinking. The fact is that the factory of the Industrial Age produced 50 times more than the family farm, and over time, 90% of the farmers were downsized. Those who survived in farming took the Industrial Age concept and created the industrialized farm. So today, only 3% of the people in the United States are farmers, who produce most of the food for the entire country and much of the world. Do you believe that the information knowledge worker age we're moving into will outproduce the Industrial Age 50 times? Think about it. I believe it will. We're just barely beginning to see it. It will outproduce it 50 times, not twice, not 3 or 10 times, but 50 or more. Nathan Myhrvold, former chief technology officer at Microsoft, put it this way. The top software developers are more productive than average software developers, not by a factor of 10 times, or 100 times, or even 1,000 times, but by 10,000 times. Close quote. Quality knowledge work is so valuable that unleashing its potential offers organizations an extraordinary opportunity for value creation. If that is true, just think of the value of unleashing the potential of your children. Knowledge work leverages all of the other investments that an organization or a family has already made. In fact, knowledge workers are the link to all of the organization's other investments. They provide focus, creativity, and leverage in utilizing those investments to better achieve the organization's objectives. The same exact thinking would apply to a family, or for a not-for-profit organization, or to a school, or a hospital, or whatever. Do you believe the knowledge worker age will eventually bring about a downsizing of up to 90% of the Industrial Age workforce? I believe it. Current outsourcing and unemployment trends are just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, these trends have become a very hot political issue. But the reality is that much of our losses in industrial-age jobs have less to do with government policy and free trade agreements than they do with the dramatic shift in our economy to a knowledge worker age. Do you think it will be threatening to today's workforce to learn the new mindset, the new skill set, and the new tool set of this new age? Imagine what it will take. Imagine what it will take for you and for me. What will it take for us to become a player in this new era? Imagine what it will require of your organization. Peter Drucker compares the industrial manual worker age with today's knowledge worker age this way. Quote, "The most important and indeed the truly unique contribution of management in the 20th century was the 50-fold increase in the productivity of the manual worker in manufacturing. The most important contribution management needs to make in the 21st century is similarly to increase the productivity of knowledge work and the knowledge worker. The most viable assets of a 20th century company were its production equipment. The most valuable asset of a 21st century institution, whether business or non-business, will be its knowledge workers and their productivity. The great historian Arnold Toynbee said that you could pretty well summarize the history of society and the institutions in it in four words. Nothing fails like success. In other words, when you have a challenge and the response is equal to the challenge, that's called success. But once you have a new challenge, the old one successful response no longer works. That's why it's called a failure. Nothing fails like success. We live in a knowledge worker age, but operate our organizations in a controlling industrial age model that absolutely suppresses the release of human potential. Voice is essentially irrelevant. This is an astounding finding. The mindset of the industrial age that still dominates today's workplace will simply not work in the knowledge worker age and the new economy. And the fact is that people have taken the same controlling mindset home. So often it dominates the way we communicate and deal with our spouses and the way we try to manage, motivate, and discipline our children. New heading. The thing mindset of the industrial age. The main assets and primary drivers of economic prosperity in the industrial age were machines and capital. Things. People were necessary but replaceable. You could control and churn through manual workers with little consequence. Supply exceeded demand. You just got more able bodies that would comply with strict procedures. People were like things. You could be efficient with them. When all you want is a person's body and you don't want their mind, heart, or spirit, all of which are inhibitors to the free-flowing processes of the machine age, you have reduced a person to a thing. So many of our modern management practices come from the industrial age. It gave us the belief that you have to control and manage people. We even talk about it. Who are the people you manage? Meaning, control. It gives us our view of accounting, which makes people an expense and machines assets. Just think about it. People are put on the P&L statement as an expense. Equipment is put on the balance sheet as an investment. It gave us our carrot and stick motivational philosophy, the great jackass technique that motivates with the carrot in front, that is the reward, and drives with the stick from behind, that is the fear of the punishment. It gave us centralized budgeting, where trends are extrapolated into the future, and hierarchies and bureaucracies are formed to drive getting the numbers. An obsolete reactive process that produces kiss-up cultures, bent on spending it so we won't lose it next year, and protecting the backside of your department. And it gave us the sandwich technique of performance appraisal, where you say a few nice words, the top part of the sandwich, then you stick in the knife, twist it a few times, called areas for improvement, and then a few nice words at the bottom to pat them on their way. All of these practices, and many, many more, came from the industrial age, working with manual workers, with things. The problem is, managers today are still applying the industrial age control model to knowledge workers, because many in positions of authority do not see the true worth and potential and voice of their people, and do not possess a complete, accurate understanding of human nature as whole human beings. They manage people as they do things. This lack of understanding also prevents them from tapping into the highest motivations, talents, and genius of people. What happens when you treat people like things today? It insults and alienates them, depersonalizes work, creates low-trust, unionized, litigious cultures. What happens when you treat your teenage children like things? It too insults and alienates, depersonalizes precious family relationships, and creates low trust, contention, and rebellion. Thus the kinds of voices that we started chapter 1 with. New heading: the downward spiral of codependency. What happens when you manage people like things? They stop believing that leadership can become a choice. That's why most people think of leadership as a position, and therefore don't see themselves as leaders. Making personal leadership or influence a choice is like having the freedom to play the piano. It is a freedom that has to be earned. Only then can leadership become a choice. It takes practicing and discipline over time. Until then, people think that only those in positions of authority should decide what must be done. They have consented, perhaps unconsciously, to being controlled like a thing. Even if they perceive a need, they don't take the initiative to act. They wait to be told what to do by the person with the formal title, and then they respond as directed. Consequently, they blame the formal leader when things go wrong and give him or her the credit when things go well. And they are thanked for their cooperation and support. This widespread reluctance to take initiative, to act independently, only fuels formal leaders' imperative to direct or manage their subordinates. This, they believe, is what they must do in order to get followers to act. And this cycle quickly escalates into codependency. Each party's weakness reinforces and ultimately justifies the other's behavior. The more a manager controls, the more he or she evokes behavior that necessitate greater control or managing. The codependent culture that develops is eventually institutionalized to the point that no one takes responsibility. Over time, you develop a culture of blame, not responsibility. Over time, both leaders and followers confirm their roles in an unconscious pact. They disempower themselves by believing that others, particularly formal leaders, must change before their own circumstances can improve. The same cycle reappears in families between parents and children. This silent conspiracy is everywhere. Not many people are brave enough to even recognize it in themselves. Whenever they hear the idea, they instinctively look outside themselves. In fact, when I teach this material to large audiences, I often pause after a couple of hours and ask the question, how many like these ideas but feel that the people who really need them aren't here? They usually explode in laughter, but literally, most hands go up. Perhaps you too are thinking that the people who really need a book like this aren't reading or listening to it. That very thought reveals codependency. If you look at this material through the weakness of another, you disempower yourself and empower their weakness to continue to suck initiative, energy, excitement, and voice from your life. And now the film. So before moving deeper, I would like to illustrate the nature of the problem we've been discussing with a great little film called Max and Max. It's a fictional story of Max the hunting dog and Max the customer service rep. It's also a story about a boss by the name of Mr. Harold who manages his employees, including his new hire Max, like he does his dog, also named Max. The setting of this short movie is the workplace. But remember, everyone has a workplace. For students, teachers, and administrators, it's a school. For many, it's a place of business, community, or government service. For families, it is the home. For yet others, it is the community, church, synagogue, or mosque. So this is not just about work. It's about human relationships and interactions between people united in a common purpose. I challenge you to translate the setting of this film into every other area you give your life to with others. People deeply relate and resonate with this film, both organizationally and personally. I invite you, I encourage you to watch Max and Max now by inserting the DVD attached to the inside back cover of the book into your DVD player and selecting Max and Max. Now think about the film you have just watched. Max, like most of us when he began a new job, is full of passion, enthusiasm, and fire. When he takes initiative to get and keep customers, Mr. Harold takes a piece of hide off him. Max is micromanaged and controlled to the point that his spirit is broken. He becomes gun-shy, and he loses his vision of his purpose, his potential, and his freedom to choose. He's lost his voice. He swears never to take initiative again. Max, the person, gets into a codependent mindset with Mr. Harold, and you can see him gradually becoming like Max the dog, just waiting for the next command. You might be tempted to blame the problem on Mr. Harold, but notice that his boss treats him just the same way he treats Max. Such insulting micromanaging is endemic throughout the whole company. The whole culture is codependent. No one is exercising leadership, that is, initiative and influence, because everyone assumes leadership is a function of position. The truth is, most organizations are not too unlike Max and Mr. Harold's. Even the best organizations I've worked with over the last 40 years are absolutely filled with problems, like the ones mentioned before. The pain from these problems and challenges is becoming much more acute because of the changes taking place in the world today. Just like with Max and Max, such challenges generally fall into three categories: organizational, relationship, and personal. At the organizational level, a controlling management philosophy drives performance, communication, compensation and reward, training and development, information, and other core systems which suppress human talent and voice. This control philosophy has its roots in the industrial age and has become the dominant management mindset of those in positions of authority across all industries and professions. Again, I call it the thing mindset of the industrial age. At the relationship level, most organizations are filled with codependency. There is a fundamental lack of trust, and many lack the skill and mindset to work out their differences in authentic, creative ways. Even though organizational systems and controlling management practices do much to foster this codependency, the problem is compounded by the fact that so many people have been raised being compared to others at home and competing against others in school, in athletics, and in the workplace. These powerful influences cultivate a scarcity mentality, a comparison-based identity, so that many people have a hard time being genuinely happy for the successes of others. And thinking in terms of voice and release instead of control and management. At the personal level, these organizations are filled with bright, talented, creative people at every level who feel straitjacketed, undervalued, and uninspired. They are frustrated and don't believe they have the power to change things. New heading: The Power of a Paradigm. Author John Gardner once said, "Most ailing organizations have developed a functional blindness to their own defects. They are not suffering because they cannot resolve their problems, but because they cannot see their problems." Einstein put it this way, "The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them." These statements underscore one of the most profound learnings of my life. If you want to make minor, incremental changes and improvements, work on practices, work on behavior, work on attitude. But if you want to make significant, quantum improvement, work on paradigms. The word paradigm stems from the Greek word paradigma, originally a scientific term but commonly used today to mean a perception, assumption, theory, frame of reference, or lens through which you view the world. In layman's language, it's like a map of a territory or city. If the map is inaccurate, it will make no difference how hard you try to find your destination, or how positive your attitude is. You'll stay lost. If it is an accurate map, then diligence and attitude do matter, but not until you have an accurate map. For instance, how did they attempt to heal people in the Middle Ages? It was called bloodletting. What was the paradigm? What was the map? The bad stuff is in the blood, so get it out. Now, if you did not question this underlying assumption, this paradigm, this map, what would you do? You'd do it more. You'd do it faster. You'd do it more painlessly. You'd go into TQM, Total Quality Management, or Six Sigma on bloodletting. You would do statistical quality controls and variance analysis. You'd do strategic feasibility studies and organize around brilliant marketing plans so that you can advertise, "We have the highest quality, world-class bloodletting unit in the world." Or you might take people into the mountains and let them do free falls off cliffs into each other's arms so that when they return to the bloodletting unit of the hospital, they work with more love and cooperation and trust. Or you might let members of the bloodletting unit sit around in hot tubs and explore their psyches with each other so that they would develop authenticity in their communication.